Fascinating how the new modern world gives you the tools to be able to combat the bad guys. There were many questions during the second part of the conversation, and I'm going to kick them off and once again pose them to you, as I did pose them at the conference. Rory Staines' question was, the plan to recover billions owed to Eskom from municipalities or for poor workmanship in particular at Medupi and Kusile. It's an interesting question because subsequent to our conference, we've seen Mike Lomas, who I'm sure you recall used to be the chief executive of a major JSE-listed company in Group 5, being brought back to the extradited back to South Africa to explain, or please explain, 1.4 billion rands worth of corruption that went on with a senior contract manager. But I guess Rory's question was, are you going to pursue, is Eskom going to be pursuing these guys?
Absolutely. This is very, very important for us. Both the employees of Eskom that are involved in these activities, we're going after them, and the people who they are working with externally, you know, regardless of who they are, which organization that work for. It could be big or small companies, we don't care. We're going after them. And the police and SIU, together with NPA, are quite helpful here. And again, we working very close with government through what is called NICOM, National Energy Crisis Committee. And that committee has been quite helpful in bringing all of the various stake organs that can help us to address this. But in the past, the quality of information has been the issue. That's where the work that we've done around AI comes into play. It just gives us a very good picture, and it helps move things forward. So that's one. In terms of the municipalities, they owe us close to 86 billion rand. And to me, that this is really a reflection of the things that are so wrong with our society, where you've got in organizations like the metros collecting money from the public, from the consumers, but not paying all that to Eskom. It says a lot about the values of our society. And this is why we have also chosen to be quite strong when it comes to this area. You may have seen or heard what we've done with Mfuleni, where we've attached three of their bank accounts and again, trying to force them to pay us. We had to resort to these kind of measures because we believe that we need to also be prioritized, you know. And this is the action that we'll continue to take, whether it is City of Johannesburg or City of Tshwane, we want to be paid. Because ultimately, there's no such a thing as free lunch. All of this has to be paid by someone, you know, and we need to get these organizations, these big metros, at least respecting the rule of law. You know, we've got contracts and they have to pay, they have to lead by example. So that is where we're coming from. And so, yes, we'll certainly do what needs to be done.
What about those who constructed Medupi and Kusile? We saw here with this tubular company, tubular construction company, where Mike Lomas was associated with. They got a big contract. They did shoddy work. But there were others as well. Hitachi even got into trouble in the United States, I think, for the work that it did at some of the Eskom plants. What happens there?
You may have seen organizations like ABB, you know, that were involved in some of the process and control instrumentation in some of these plants. And they charge us sometimes double what was supposed to have been charged us. And we have pursued them together with SIUs. And in fact, an organization like ABB paid close to about 2 or 3 billion rand back to Eskom. So these are ongoing activities that we're working very closely with SIU around. You know.
Piet Viljoen's question was, what chance that Eskom goes into a death spiral, that it prices itself out of the market?
I don't see that being the case, as you have heard me saying that our first, our next priority after energy security is to drive down the affordability question. And many people think that there is this massive amount of movement away from Eskom, which I think maybe they wish that it may be the case, but the reality is not the case. The reality is that most businesses, as much as they may go the renewable route, they expect the base load to come from Eskom, you know. And if you look at now, a number of them, you know, get asked to come and present to boards, to present to some of the industry organizations. Why? Because people are looking at the investments. You know, we've got limited funds that are out there. You know, if there's supply from Eskom that is reliable, should we continue with the plans that we had to go do X, Y, Z? So those are the things that are going in the heads of many boards. And many of them, actually, they know that Eskom, a reliable Eskom, still continues to be available at a cost that is affordable. They prefer that route compared to something else. So what we have done, I don't see us pricing ourselves out. We are conscious of the cost. And as we also move into more and more renewables, bringing them now, because the cost curve of those renewables is quite down, as we bring them in, we are going to be competitive and continue to drive down the cost of electricity. So I don't see a problem. The key, though, was to make sure that we regain the trust of the public. We are not yet there. We'll have to continue to deliver. And many businesses are very, very supportive of what we're doing and actually putting on hold some of their capital expenditure that they had planned.
We're well past 175 days now of no load shedding. Perhaps you could also unpack for us what you told the delegates at the conference about the load shedding scenario, when you expect that it will be almost guaranteed that there'll be no more load shedding.
Yeah. So one of the things that we did when this board was announced in October 2022, we spent a lot of time engaging with the power station general managers, together with Jan, who was the COO, where we tried to get to understand what the issues were. And that to us as the board was very important, so that whatever we come up with, it needs to talk to the real problem. And from there, we got a sense that we had actually diagnosed the problem in the wrong way. The problem was not so much the aging fleet, but it was the unreliability of the fleet. This may sound like, you know, it's semantics, but it's not, because when you've got an aging fleet problem, really the thing that you do there is that I don't want to spend good money and just chasing bad thing. Let's allow these power stations to retire. Let's not invest anything on them. So that's really that was the prevailing view at the time. And we kind of came to a different conclusion that no, we can fix these power stations. We bring them back to a point of being reliable. And we came up with this plan called the Generation Recovery Plan, which was a two-year plan. And it was approved by the board in the middle of March last year. And it's a two-year plan. And our expectation was that by end of March this year in 2024, we will have an energy availability factor of 65% coming from 51% a year ago. And then by the end of March 2025, we'll be sitting at energy availability factor of 70%. That's really where we are now. We're already at 65%, so we're in line with the plan. And we have a number of actions to take to get us to a point where we can say that the EAF is sitting at 70%. When it is at that point, it will have enough reserve margin. We generally always have to have something like 10 to 15% reserve margin above the demand, you know. And we're already in some days this year already sitting at that level. So, but until we are complete with the work that we had planned to do, we are not going to be declaring victory too soon, you know. But we expect by the end of March next year, we should be in that position.
That's really good news. And I guess from that perspective, there can be further investments taken by those companies who've now postponed their investments in their own renewables and on the reliability factor. Steve Kolenbrander's question was, what did Eskom get so wrong?
Look, I think there are a number of things that we got right. Let me put it that way. There are a number of things that came together to get us to where we are. First, to have people that were a board that is much more engaged. That is important, you know. Ask questions. Don't just take what you are being told and just move with that. Try and get to the root. What is the root of the problem? And unfortunately, sometimes when you go that route, you can make people uncomfortable. I'm talking management. But it's our responsibility as the board to continue to ask questions, not to do the work of management, but to ask questions so that we can have a good understanding of what. So that was something that happened. And then once you have a clear understanding of what the issues are, you ask yourself, do I have the resources that can help me to address this problem that is in front of me? In this case, we found that our relationship, Eskom's relationship with the original equipment manufacturers was no longer there. You know, we're working through middlemen. And most of those companies did not really have the expertise that were required to help us to fix the machines when they were down. So we then restored those relationships. And I'm saying it's restored, it looks like it's easy, but this is something that is part of the policy of the government, where we had to engage with the National Treasury and get the necessary approvals for Eskom to be able to do this. So that's a big thing. Now, when you are taking the machines for maintenance, you know that when they're coming back, they're going to be in a better position than we took them out. When in reality, in the past, you would find that it's actually they are in the worst position, you know. Yeah. So that's the second big thing that had to be done. Then leadership. And to me, this is one of the most important part of all of this, is leadership at all levels, you know, starting with the leadership at a generation level, where this organization was led by somebody that was in an acting capacity. They cannot make decisions. They are acting. They are uncomfortable with making big decisions, you know. And we had to accelerate the appointment of the leader. We were also part, I'm talking now the board, part of the people, the panel that was doing the interview, supporting them to make sure that we get the right person. And we managed to find that right person within Eskom. And that was very important. When we look at the people that was provided by the recruitment agency, we just felt it looks like they did not understand the briefs. Mm-hmm. Anyway, long story short, we managed to get Bacon Romalo, who then became the leader that looked at his entire team of people that are driving the power stations and asking himself the question, do I have the right leaders in the power station? And if not, because he even knew the people inside the organization, he knew who knows what, who has got what experience in which power station, he managed to go get those people that had been sidelined, move them back into the roles that they are now occupying. So that's the other element of this. The other one is linked to the fact that this group of people, I'm talking the entire ESCOM, had been, I'll call it collective punishment, no salary increases for 5 years. You may think that maybe they don't deserve a salary increase because we did not have the lights on. But that is the wrong approach if you want to drive change in an organization. I found that most people in the organization are trying to do the right thing, and we were able to restore some of that. The other important tool that we lacked was short-term incentives. If you want to drive behavior, you need to have these incentives that will you link to performance. Right now, we no longer driving from the center and trying to crack the whip and do this and that. It's all driven largely by the incentive structure that we have created, where the power stations are competing with one another for around excellence. That's just what you want. You want an environment where people, high performance is just something that they aspire to. And so a combination of all of these things together with a minister, the late Pravin Gordhan was very, very supportive when it comes to removal of the issues that were linked to government. Government is the government that said there should be no salary increases. The government that removed short-term incentives. It's the government that said the board is no longer responsible for the pay of executives. We had to get all of those things back. You need a board that has empowered, able to drive its agenda, and he helped us to get to that point. We also were supported by the Minister of Energy and Electricity, who at the time when Andre had left us, we did not really have a CEO. And he kind of, we working very closely with him, he became that person who was the communication person, both for government and for us.
And managing upwards, given that you've got a shareholder that you've articulated now, the late Pravin Gordhan, the Minister of Energy, of Electricity rather, what came out quite strongly as well in your talk was that there had been very little communication between Eskom and its shareholder.
Yeah, look, I'm someone who I've been a CEO before, and the priority of a CEO is really, really to focus on managing stakeholders. It could be investor community, it could be employees, it could be, the government. All of that is the responsibility of the leader of an organization. And the thing that we did when Dan joined this company, we said, Dan, we do not want you to be spending any time with the media, at least in the first 100 days. Your job is really to focus on, one, you need to get yourself under the hood, under the covers, get to understand what the issues are, and then look at the plan that you already found in flight. See if you want to make those changes to that plan. Then the next thing is, when you're coming to us, you can no longer say that this is your plan. You need to own it, because you must change it to reflect whatever you think needs to be changed. So look at that plan, first 100 days, to understand what's going on. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, we need to participate in renewables as an entity. You need to come back to us with a clear plan on how are you planning to participate in renewables. And the third thing is, we want to make sure that you need to rebuild our connections with the different stakeholders. And I was asked as the chairman to be the person who go and introduce him to the different stakeholders. And in particular in government, I would go to the Minister of Mr. Mantashe, for example, set up meetings, introduce him there. I was very surprised when we had the meeting with with ministers, some of the ministers saying to me, you know, if you remember the last time we had a meeting like this is probably 9 years or 10 years ago. And I'm like, wow, you know, these are ministries that you need to influence. You may not agree with them. It doesn't matter. But because you operate under them, you need to find a way of working with them, influencing them, so that they can create a good environment for your organization to work. So we had to reestablish those connections that had completely been broken.
George Nikolakakis asked for the status of criminal organizations that we read so much about in Andre de Ruyter's book and their tentacles within Eskom.
Look, I've already indicated that the work that we've done through the use of the AI has helped us to have a good feel of who is doing what within the organization and their connection with people external, with the companies external to Eskom. And to handle that, to address that, we then set up as a board an office in the office of the CEO that deals directly with this issue, and we have capacitated that office, brought in with also support from the private sector to help with the writing of these cases and things like that, and to speed things up, and also to make sure that there is no issue around bias where maybe internally the employees may decide to be, you know, I know this one, I don't know, you know, they don't follow the, you know, the right way of doing. So we've managed to get external support that is is helping us to address this thing. So that's the big thing that we've done. But the other important thing that I would like to learn is that just by putting the right leaders in the different power stations, that was an important step forward. Because what that does is that if you've got leaders that are not leading or managers that are not managing, you end up having chaos in those environments. Just by bringing people that bring in the discipline and are able to check things, you know, when I get a delivery from a particular company delivering so many tons of coal, I need to check, did I really get what I ordered, you know? And was it the quantity, the quality, all of that? If I only pick that up 6 months down the line, clearly there's a problem on my side. I should be able to pick up immediately or the day after. You know, by just having the right leaders, that eliminates some of the chaos that was happening just because we did not have, you know, people looking at these things. So the work that was done by Becky to appoint the right leaders in some of this power station has gone a long way. And it also improved the morale of the staff. People in working in any organization, they like to know, where are we going? They don't like to work in a chaotic environment. You like to know if they are showing up and showing up well, they are going to be recognized. You know, if you are working in an environment where whether I apply myself or not, I will be treated the same. People are not going to, drive. They're not going to put their whole selves into the work that they're expected to do. So the work, that's why I kept emphasizing this thing, leadership matters. It matters at all levels. It creates the right environment for people to want to shine, those who want to shine. For those who do not want to perform, the leaders have difficult conversations with them to improve or maybe to leave the company, you know. And that's what we're seeing more and more within Eskom right now.
Leadership, leadership, leadership. Here's a related question. Jabu Ngube asked, does Eskom have a succession plan to ensure that the next group of leadership is as efficient as the ones who now appear to be installed?
Yeah, look, as a board, we have a responsibility to make sure that there is succession planning, at least for the key executive roles within ESCOM. And that is our priority. We currently, you know, working with Dan to bring in people within ESCOM at executive levels. And as we're thinking about, as we're bringing these leaders into ESCOM, top of mind is this whole issue around succession. Yes, we are bringing someone for this role, but you're asking yourself the question, can this person do the next role? Does they have the capacity to do? You see, that's what we're doing right now. And I'm comfortable with the work that is being driven by our Human Capital and Remuneration Committee together with management to build this. As well, one of the things that we have recommended to the minister is that when they're rotating, when they're changing the board, you know, in the past you change the board, all of them at the same time bringing the new, we need to have some kind of continuity here. Otherwise, some of the good work can just be destroyed. You know, we're coming to the end of our term in October next year. If the entire board were to be removed, and that would have a problem, I think. You know, so we have made a recommendation, which is supported, I think, by the minister, that at least we keep 2/3 of the board. So every year, each term, you remove a third of the and bring in new, but at least keep at least 2/3 to ensure continuity. And if that works here, it could just be one of the things that we take to other state-owned enterprises.
Tim Aitken's question was, how will ESCOM manage to solve its debt issue and make tariffs more competitive for industry?
Yeah. Our debt situation, I think it is largely solved. You know, when the government of South Africa last year decided to support ESCOM to the tune of about 260 billion rand, that, of course, over a three-year period, it was not something that was going to be paid to ESCOM all at once. That will change completely the balance sheet of ESCOM. So that's very, very important, that injection. What we do not want, though, we don't want to get to a point where 5 years or 10 years down the line, you want the government to come back and bail you out. No. So that's the first thing. That has helped a lot. It will help. And the next thing was get the generation fleet to be reliable so that you are able to sell the electricity that you can sell. You know, load shedding was not a good business for ESCOM because there are lost sales there. You know, so if you just look at the last 4 months now, the year on year, the growth, the top line growth, it is something that we are very, very happy with. And that's how it should be. You know, and there needs to be top line growth. And if we maintain, and we will maintain that for the full year, that is great, you know, to have a decent growth on the top line. So that's the first piece. The second important thing, because you are not doing load shedding, you do not need any more diesel. You know, we spent the year when we were doing most of the maintenance, we spent 33 billion rand of diesel. Because we had to minimize the impact of load shedding, because we were deliberately removing this equipment to go and maintain them, but to minimize the impact to the economy, we used what is called OCGTs, open cycle gas turbines. The load factor of these machines are supposed to be around 7%. We were running at load factors of around 24%. You know, you can see how hard we were running these things. Where we are now, year to date, load factor is way below 7%, sitting at 2.5%. You know, and that's how it should be. You only use these machines during peak times. Sometimes, you know, during in winter, during morning peak or evening peak, use them only for those 1 or 2 hours, and that's it. You know. And that's how these machines were designed. We're using them for that. Think about it now. 33 billion rand of diesel that we spent last year, we will hardly get to, let's say, 8 billion rand this year. All of that is savings, you know. And why at the back of reliable machines, you know. So that is very important. That goes to the bottom line. Then the third element is the fact that we have this debt relief from government, and it's helping us reduce our interest charge. That as well, that saving. So a combination of that, that's why I say that it's going to be interesting. We're probably getting to a point of profitability sooner than most South Africans think, at the back of the reliability of our machines. Top line growth, savings on diesel, and then the help that we'll receive from government.
Richard Hirsch's question is, when will Eskom allow households to feed back into the grid? He says he's been waiting for 14 months for this.
Yeah, a lot of work has been done around this to I can't remember now the term of, but I think it's feed-in tariff, yeah. But what you need is you also need to have a meter that is able to facilitate this. And you know that by the end of this year, Eskom has been saying that people must upgrade their meters and do all of that. It is preparing for that reality. So once we get the meters, all of the meters in our homes upgraded, and we have a model that allows people to feed, because we need NERSA. We need NERSA to approve that, and NERSA is working on this. I just can't remember now the name of this mechanism of netting. You know, you look at what you have bought, and you're also looking at what you have sold to Eskom, and then, or it's called net billing. And that is what they are working on.
Bruce Dakers' question is, what is Eskom's view on nuclear power?
That's an interesting... nuclear power has served us well as Eskom. I mean, to look at Kubek, it's one of the cheapest... if you look, we stack the cost of each one of these sources of energy, and you look at which one is costing you the least, you know, and that's the one you dispatch first. That's why it is so painful to us when we have to dispatch IPPs that are costing us more as a priority more than the coal, you know. When you look at how Kubek has performed, it's one of the cheapest and much more reliable and clean, of course. And we've never really had a problem from a safety perspective around nuclear in Quebec. We need to continue to have those expertise in our country. And the discussions now around nuclear, the new area of investment, is something that is interesting for us. Because think about it, these power stations of ours, in particular the coal power stations, as they get to the end of life, if we can replace those with small nuclear power stations, we don't have to invest as a country on transmission lines, you know, and you'll have this small modular power stations all over. And we believe that is the right way of going about doing it. And so we are open to it. We are encouraging it in this part of our plan for the future. And we're thinking renewables for us, the clean, it involves nuclear, it involves solar, wind, and also there's an element of gas as well as a transition technology.
That follows up with another question that was asked by Pete Stain, who said, what about the pebble bed modular reactors, which South Africa had done a lot of investment into and then abandoned at a point? Is that being dusted off? Pete Lowe, not Pete Stain. Pete Lowe.
Yeah. You know, where we are now, we really are not in a position to be trying stuff that is not tested. You know, as much as it was good for the country to be investing and doing innovation around that, it would be irresponsible, we think, of this board, given the challenges that we have as a country around just the finances of the country. So right now, our thinking is that we want to go with technology that's proven, you know, and there are a number of countries that have got those proven technologies. It's France, I think it's Russia and a few others. You know, we probably would be looking at that. The technology that we're using in Quebec is from France, you know.
Michael Potts, we're coming to the end of our list of questions for you. Wanted to know, will Eskom consider... he was asking about the pebble bed technology. It wasn't Pete Lowe, my apologies. Mike Wiley asked a rather controversial question. When will Eskom be cutting down its bloated staff, many of whom are inept and corrupt?
Yeah, so in answering that question, I remember the presentation that was made by Marius, who was the gentleman who presented first.
That was Franz Cronier.
Oh, Franz Cronier, yeah. Franz Cronier, one of his observations around South Africa was that actually South Africa is not a country of people are sitting in extremes, you know. General South Africans are largely in the middle, you know. They are not a radical South Africa. And I think that was it's a good observation. We always get worried when we're going through elections and say, we should know South Africans better by now. You know, they have never disappointed. You know, you can hear all of these people that are far right or far left, but they never attract the majority of South Africans. You know, most South Africans are really in the middle. I'm making this as a point that, again, when it comes to on any organization that I've been, I found that many South Africans are trying to do the right thing. People are really, the majority of people are people who want to do the right thing. And that's no different in Eskom, you know. And it's even more so now that we have done this work that we've done, we can see that it's actually, you know, the percentages are in line with this theory that I have, that the majority of South Africans, of employees of Eskom, just want to do the right thing. And also when I look at how much information we're getting from the employees of Eskom, highlighting some of the people, you know, it's so nice that your tool, your AI tool, gives you this information, and then it gets collaborated by people on the ground saying that, hey, so and so and this and this, they are doing wrong things. That's a good thing, you know, and that's what we see. So most people, most of our employees are really, really employees that are, that they care deeply about the company. They wanted to get back to its glory days. and they're trying to, they're working with management to root out the wrong people. But on your point, on his point around the, you know, the size of the staff, I've already mentioned this. I think that's our next phase as an organization, where we have to, we've asked then to benchmark ourselves against other players out there and see if, you know, the number of employees, all sorts of things, look at how well are we running, how efficient are we running the ESCOM. And this is where I think it's going to be painful, you know, in the next phase when we're taking out the cost. We have to take out the cost if we are not efficient in certain areas. And that's what needs to be done. And that's a leadership job. We have to do it. And but it needs to be supported by data. You know, it has to be evidence-based. And we are doing that piece of work right now.
The last question from Mark Taylor. He said, where did Andre go wrong? And what did he do right? Referring to Andre de Ruyter.
I think Andre, I don't like to comment on the past leaders of any organization that I'm part of. I think that's not our responsibility as the current leaders to do that, and we need to always be just looking at what the problem is and fixing that problem, because we're not paid to be, you know, saying all sorts of things around the leaders that were there before us. Really, the job, our job is to fix the problems that we have. I do think, though, that he did the right thing by highlighting some of the corruption that is in ESCOM, and he was not wrong with that. We have taken the work that he has done, moved it to the next level to say, okay, he had a feeling that there was corruption. We no longer have a feeling. We know. And we know who's doing what, and we're taking action around those people, you know, and that was brave of him to say that. I think he could have he could have spent more time on the ground, trying to understand and listen more to the people that are in ESCOM, that understand that environment. My own sense as a leader as a CEO in the past is that wherever I've been, I've spent a lot of time before coming up with a strategy. You spend a lot of time on the ground, just listening and hearing things out to understand, because the people that are closest to the problems, those are the ones that have got insights that you may want to integrate as part of your strategy. You know, I think he could have done a lot more around that. He could have. You need also the support of the people within your own organization. You know, I think he had a lot of support externally, but what surprised me, that support coming into organization, there was really no support. You know, and that's dangerous. You know, who are you leading? When so nobody is following you, you know, that's a problem, you know. So I would say those will be the things that I observed. But yeah, I generally do not like to comment about the past leaders.
Mteto, thank you again for devoting more time to us. Thank you for being at the BizNews conference and for the inspirational talk that you delivered there and followed up here. I'm sure that the message that you're giving to South Africa is one that will add to this flow of uplifting information that we seem to be getting at last in our country. Mteto Nyati is the chair of ESCOM. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.